You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll meet the creator of the online memorial project, Who We Lost, where people can pay tribute to loved ones lost during the pandemic. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Ramadan, which wrapped up earlier this week.
1.8 billion Muslims all over the world observe the holy month of Ramadan. That includes the children at the Crescent Learning Center, an Islamic childcare center in Milwaukee. Reporter Christina Leffring tells us the center's founder strives to help refugee children and their parents feel at home during the holiday and through the rest of the year.
Crescent Learning Center is like any typical childcare center. Kids play with clay.
It's a teddy bear.
They make gifts for Mother's Day.
It's a hug for your mom.
And, of course, there's Baby Shark. But it's also unique because this is an Islamic childcare center. And it's the month of Ramadan, the holiest month of the year for Muslims.
The kids get excited about Ramadan.
That's Rafat Arain, the founder and director at Crescent Learning Center. The kids we just heard are too young to fast, which means no food or water from sunrise to sunset. But their families still wake up early to eat a big breakfast before sunrise and share a big feast at the end of the day when the sun sets. The whole community gathers in homes and at mosques to celebrate. And for the kids who are old enough to fast, it is a joyous rite of passage.
The parents do put more effort in making their favorite things, samosas and all those brownies and all of those, the things that the kids love. It's exciting for the kids.
It's also a lesson in gratitude for what you have and empathy for those who have less than you.
There are so many people in this world that don't have any food. We are giving up this food out of choice, but a lot of people have no choice. They just don't have the food. So you feel their pain too. You have to feel the pain of hunger that a lot of people are going through.
Which may be closer to home than the children realize. Arain, who's originally from Pakistan, started working with refugees in 1993 when her family took in a family that had fled the war in Bosnia. Since then, she's worked to help each new wave of refugees resettle in Milwaukee. Somali, Burmese, Rohingya, and most recently, Afghan.
I think I have a weakness for the refugees somehow. I was never a refugee myself, but I just feel that it would be... I came to this country, I spoke English, I was educated, I didn't have to, you know, go through all of that. We are in this world for a purpose, not just to eat and drink and sleep and take care of ourselves. We have to do it for others. If I have this education, it's not for me to keep it to myself, it is to share it with others. That's everything that we have.
She decided to open the childcare center when she saw refugee kids were falling behind in school. The center opens early and closes late to accommodate parents' work schedules. And during the pandemic, the center stayed open and staff helped the kids with virtual school. Arain's office is set up to welcome parents with tea, snacks, and a sofa where they can sit and talk. She's also hired staff from several refugee communities.
See, I have Burmese staff, I have Somali staff, I have Arabic staff, I have Moroccan staff. When those people come to me, I have translators over here. A lot of parents depend on me. They have problems. I have the sofa, they come. It's a good thing. Someday I might need help. God will send somebody for me.
Back in the classroom, children are encouraged to give to charity. And as the teachers warm up their halal lunch, they remind the children to say Bismillah.
Say Bismillah!
A blessing before eating their rice and vegetables. Most of these children are too young to fast for Ramadan or to remember what their families went through when they left their home countries. But one day they'll join millions of Muslims around the world as they remember to be grateful for the roof over their head, the food on their plate, and the people who've helped them call Milwaukee home.
Christina Leffring brought us that story on Ramadan and the Crescent Learning Center in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a lot of people have lost loved ones during the pandemic, and grieving has been difficult, at first because in-person ceremonies were largely off the table, and later because so many elements of the disease got tied up in political debate. Our next guest set out to change that with a website that is helping people grieve COVID-related deaths in their lives by sharing written anecdotes. The website provides a space for those memories that's explicitly free from negative pandemic-related comments. Martha Greenwald is a writer based in Kentucky and founder of the Who We Lost Project. Martha, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where did you first get the inspiration to launch this?
So this project has really evolved a lot. We began sort of inspired by the particularly empathic response that Kentucky had at the beginning of the pandemic, but then word began to get out about it nationally. And I fielded numerous requests from people who wanted to write stories from outside the state. Personally, my own father was killed in a strange accident about a decade ago, and the pandemic helped me to see how much disenfranchised grief I was still carrying with me. There's a lot of parallels to that with COVID deaths, the inability to say goodbye, the uncertainty, family dysfunction, and it awakened a lot of things in me. And in combination with the fact of having taught writing for 20 years, and I wanted all that experience to be useful to others. And so I feel it's kind of a calling for me.
Can you give us a couple examples of things people have written that we might see on your site?
Sure. I'll give you a story, well, a little excerpt of a story first from Colorado. This story is about Kyle Spiller, and it was written by his mom. And the title is Dog Boy and Holiday Guy. One thing I should say that's important about the site is that everyone has to put a title on their story. I feel like it gives it a sense of narrative and it kind of gives it a dignity to it that I feel is rather essential. So this is from Dog Boy and Holiday Guy. Kyle was our holiday maker. He refused to let a holiday go by without a get together. The only one we missed was Christmas 2020 because I was just too nervous about the virus. But that Thanksgiving, we had a big meal in the living room of our half-finished house. Bare gray block walls, a late November Colorado breeze blowing through the many openings yet to be filled with windows and doors, a football game on the TV, a microwave to reheat the quickly cooling food. A memorable day, to say the least. We sat across the room from each other in green lawn chairs, Mike and I on one side, Kyle and Charlotte on the other, but we were together, and that's what mattered to Kyle. And I really love that story because there's so many details in it that I feel are just, you know, such a good evocation of social isolation and everything that everyone else was going through, really exemplified there.
And so many of your examples, I compare them to obituaries. You know, I've read them. I've helped write them for family members who have passed. I feel like in these stories, even sometimes just one-line excerpts, I know more about a person than in reading a whole obituary. Can you talk about how you suggest people dig into those feelings and find those unique things?
Sure. So one thing that we have on the site is a writing toolbox, because a lot of people are writing hesitant, or it harkens back to like bad English class memories from years ago or something like that. So I just kind of do what I did when I was teaching, which is we provide examples. So I really believe if you show people what a detail is and, you know, what a memory is that should be important, that it easily helps them conjure that up for themselves. So the writing toolbox helps. And then also in our social media campaigns, I post sort of 1 to 2 sentence micro stories that are specific and help people evoke what's going on for them at that time.
Some of those are amazing. The one sentence was, I jotted a couple of those down. One was his favorite karaoke song was Rock Lobster. I feel like I know something about that person. I wish I could have hung out with him just knowing that one little snippet.
Yeah, exactly. Like that gives you a time and place, right? It helps you probably remember, you know how old they were without even saying it. And you can picture the whole scene of them and how much you would miss them singing that song. So yeah, that's exactly what we're aiming for, is to, you know, show that it's important to remember those things and not just the hospital and the ventilator.
I think you said you had another reading you could share with us, Martha.
Sure. This is also an excerpt. Some of the stories are, you know, long, mm-hmm. so we can't read them all now, but this is from Kentucky. It's for Mother's Day, which is coming up on Sunday, and I highly encourage people to come write a story for Mother's Day. It's by Shane Terry of Whitesburg, Kentucky. This is a small snippet of his story called Yellow Roses. Recently, I was digging through my archive of old video footage, and I found something that surprised me. It was video of my mother a year before she died, showing me the rose bush at the end of the driveway, the one my sister and I had bought to replace the bushes that had burned up. The new bush that we'd planted was pink or red, I can't remember exactly. But oddly enough, when the bush began to flower, the roses were yellow, the color of hope and light and happiness. My mom was amazed. That's what she's showing us in the video, her joy that they'd transformed themselves. It seemed to be a sign at the time that things would get better, a little miracle that happened to us after losing so much.
What do you think people get out of writing about this grief, especially this, I think you use the phrase disenfranchised grief?
Well, disenfranchised grief is unfortunately very common right now, and it's commonly what a person would experience when they incur a loss that can't be openly acknowledged or socially sanctioned. Maybe they can't mourn publicly, which was, of course, a big part of the first year, at least, of COVID. So when they have that, they didn't really, you know, get the opportunity due to social isolation to hold in-person funerals, you know, so the things that would have been said at a wake or Shiva, a memorial, were kept silent, and they were maybe rattled off or awkwardly on Zoom. But, you know, Who We Lost offers a space to tell that story, maybe about your best friend from 40 years ago, or the thing that you couldn't say. I'm finding people talk to me a lot lately when I'm out, as though they kind of know, like, what my deal is. And I feel that right now there's memories in the air that are sort of floating like pollen. There's so much sadness and loss and things that have been hidden or suppressed for all the 2 years of isolation, and now they're coming out, and the grief sort of reemerges with the person. So I think, you know, these stories have to be told.
Martha, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Martha Greenwald, a writer based in Kentucky, founder of the project Who We Lost. We talked to her today about how that online project is helping people grieve loved ones whose deaths were related to COVID-19 by writing. We'll get a link to Who We Lost at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, staying with the topic of memory and the pandemic, the Wisconsin Historical Society started collecting COVID-19 journal entries from Wisconsinites back in the spring of 2020. We'll get an update on how that project has been going and what people have been sharing. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. A project here in the state has been collecting written chronicles of the experiences of Wisconsinites during the pandemic in their own words. That project's one of two that the Wisconsin Historical Society started in the spring of 2020 at the beginning of the novel coronavirus outbreak in the state. They asked people to submit journal entries for historical record and commissioned public information posters as well. We wanted to get an update on how those efforts have gone 2 years now after they started. Christian Overland is the Ruth and Hartley Barker Director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society. Christian, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be back with you again.
Can you remind us of the original inspiration to do this journal project?
Oh, sure. So back in March of 2020, when the pandemic was hitting, we started looking at our 1918 pandemic collections. And it was one of our archivists, Jonathan Nelson, who said, you know, if we're going to help people out, we can talk about the public health commissions and what happened back then. There's some good stuff that we can share with the Department of Health Services and the public. But he said, I'm struggling because we don't have the voice of the people from the 1918 pandemic. And so Jonathan proposed in late March that we actually start a journaling project to actually document the voice of the people of Wisconsin that were experiencing the pandemic. And we launched April 2nd. And quite frankly, we thought it was going to be a 30 or 60 or 90 day project. And a couple of years later, here we are.
Yeah, I talked to you a couple years ago at the outset of this project that we were all, I think, hoping would be a short-term project. Can you talk about the response you got?
Sure. So we thought this would be interesting for Wisconsin, all 72 counties, and certainly that's panned out. But we've had over 2,500 people sign up to journal. And so people have been contacting Jonathan and his team. We've actually had 218 journals submitted thus far. And people are still working on that. But what's fascinating about it, the last time we talked, Rob, is people were talking about the issue of quarantining, food shortages, you know, being alone, not having human contact. But now we're getting the journals coming in with all that, plus the idea of vaccination. And as your guest previously discussed, the loss of life too. And that's coming through these journals.
If people are out there thinking, oh, I wish I had done this, could they still join in and pick up where they are now?
Oh, absolutely, Rob. You know, we're never going to close down this project because we think that there's journals still out there. And one of the things that people can do is they can go onto our website and click on Collecting as It Happens. And they can see how we're documenting the COVID project through journaling. And they have rubrics there. There are prompts for writing. And we make it easier for people to create their own journal. The other thing I'll say is it's just not paper. We also collect art journals, video journals, digital journals, any format is starting to come in.
What are your hopes for the Wisconsinites of the future when they have this collection available to them?
So going back to why Jonathan started this and what's really panned out, the gift to the future is some of the innovations that people have done socially, you know, going through this. They're documenting, you know, what they ate, what were some of the recipes they could buy with limited food connections. They're also documenting what they did on their social time, not being connected with people physically. So some remember some of the Zoom meetings and maybe Zoom parties that were going on. They were documenting that as well. And also documenting what their children were doing with online school, and also how they were dealing with the pandemic, whether they were using the recommendations that the Department of Health Services and CDC were giving out, or not, and how they felt about that. So what's great about this is we're giving a voice to the future of how we managed and persevered through the pandemic.
It sounds like there's a lot of variety in responses. If I understand correctly, you've gotten one journal that's 400 pages long, another has 13 handwritten volumes. Can you give us a sense of the variety that you've gotten from people so far?
So, like I said, they're from all over Wisconsin, plus they're from Wisconsinites around the world. So we just received one from Italy in the past few months. We also have them from Texas, California, the East Coast. We know that people are still journaling in different parts of the world. But the other part, too, is it's from all socioeconomic backgrounds. They're very diverse. So from a 14-year-old to a 90-year-old, from poets to people that are doing art journals. Some of the more fascinating ones are people that are drawing and putting articles together and writing about that. There's one journal that actually is using Beatles tunes to actually the lyrics of them to comment on how they feel about it as a prompt. They'll put a Beatles song out there and write it, draw a little picture, and then talk about what they were feeling that week.
There's a mindset that I always kind of struggle to grasp a little bit here, Christian, that, you know, in my head sometimes history is back then. But we're living through history now, and the future's going to look at this as history. As people write these things, do you get the sense that they're seeing themselves as part of the historical process here?
Definitely, they do that. There is that. But we've had a history of that, mm-hmm. You know, Rob, that goes back to the 19th century when our first director sent out with the Civil War troops that were being mustered out of Camp Randall in Madison, journals and pencils, and asking the troops to write about their journeys and bring them back. So there's a self awareness going on just like back then of what they're writing about. But there's also a lot of breakthrough things that are happening too. A lot of people are expressing themselves emotionally and actually how they feel about what's happening in the world during the time. What we could not have thought about back then in March when we launched, thinking about this project and launching it in April, was like the murder of George Floyd, or what's going now with the war of Ukraine. These things are continually to be journaled about. So we're capturing an era of time that's kind of being enveloped by the pandemic. Lots of things happening in the world that are being chronicled now by Wisconsin people.
Now, I mentioned earlier there was a companion project with asking people to produce public information posters. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So if people have the image of like Uncle Sam wants you from World War One, that type of poster, or the 1930s Depression era posters where, you know, we're all working together type of thing from the WPA. We use that type of rubric to work with Wisconsin artists and giving Wisconsin artists voices. So we did a first run of 10 publications of posters, graphic arts posters, in 20. And then we did another 10 in 21. And they're fascinating because, again, they're coming from diverse artist backgrounds. And they were posted in hospitals, schools. One of the things that happened with our journaling project is schools started to get on board, even the colleges. We have classes from Marquette, as well as the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And even the senior citizens home was journaling about it. But they saw the COVID poster projects, and they started wanting them too. So it's another voice from the artistic community that's being given a platform to express their ideas. And one of the cool things that happened with it is that from the COVID journaling project, along with the poster project, a professor in Eau Claire, University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, BJ Hollers, decided to write a book called Hope is a Thing. And he used it to kind of add to the collection by asking people to write essays about the COVID project and put them together in a book. And then one of the artists did the cover for it. So in many ways, it's became its own innovation, spurring ideas to document history during the time we're living in today.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Christian Overland, director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society, looking at their journal project. You can find more at wisconsinhistory.org/journalproject. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at the long tradition of music as political protest and how the protest song has changed over time. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then housing in Wisconsin has gotten increasingly unaffordable. Our guest says the problem is a five-alarm fire. We'll hear about the factors contributing to it and what policymakers could do to try to bring those costs down. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at what could change around the country if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade as suggested in a leaked draft ruling. First, housing costs jumped in Wisconsin during the pandemic. That's pushing the dream of home ownership further away for a lot of people. And it's adding pressure to the state's rental market, too. Our next guest says the problem has gotten so bad it should be considered a five-alarm fire. And if he says if trends continue, it could cause young people to leave the state altogether, adding to problems with Wisconsin's worker shortage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen housing costs go up where you live? Did you try to buy a home during the pandemic? How'd it go? If you're a renter, what's it been like trying to find an affordable place to rent? Builders and landlords love to hear your perspective, too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kurt Paulson is a professor of urban planning at UW-Madison. Kurt, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
I feel like I say this a lot. This is a problem that was going on before the pandemic, and it seems like the pandemic made it worse. Let's go back to pre-pandemic. What were we starting to see then with our housing market?
So across Wisconsin, and particularly in our faster growing counties, you saw pre-pandemic the fact that we simply did not build enough housing to keep up with population growth and job growth. And so that meant that prices were going up even before the pandemic. And for younger families, first-time home buyers, renters, that meant that it was even hard to find a home, even though interest rates were kind of low, and we were still building a lot of homes. So as you pointed out in the introduction, COVID is just fanning the flames of an already existing kind of burning ember. And in COVID, we saw a huge increase in demand as people realized they wanted to get more space. And then the supply chain difficulties meant that lumber, appliances, all sorts of inputs into housing just skyrocketed in cost.
We'll tackle each of those in turn. What was leading to that shortfall in housing construction that wasn't keeping up with the growth in demand, again, even pre-pandemic?
Right. So as we like to say, when there's a high demand for housing in an area, it's usually caused by job growth or amenities that people want, such as schools. So the solution is always to build more housing where people want to live. But you asked about the challenge. And the true challenge is that most of the people who are already living there don't want more housing to be built. So every time a developer is proposing whether a couple of houses or an apartment building, it has to go through a zoning and local government approval process. And the existing homeowners in the community generally take the view that our neighborhood is full. We can't take more housing. We don't want the extra traffic or school children to crowd the schools. So it's largely, but not completely, driven by the local land use approval process that doesn't allow more housing to be built where people want to live.
Now let's
the other the other factor, of course, is after the Great Recession, banks and lenders tightened lending standards, which just makes it harder for a builder to get a land loan to start building new housing.
Then here comes the pandemic. You mentioned the increased building costs. Can you give us a sense of how big those are? Looking at charts of, you know, lumber and some other things, you really see how much they've increased.
Right. So we like to say that lumber for a 1,000 board feet used to be about $200. And during the pandemic, it was five or six times that, even up to $1,200 for a 1,000 board feet. Today, it's cheap. It's down to only $900. That's meant as a joke. Mm-hmm. It still means that for a single family home, of normal framing costs might be about $30,000. And now it might be $75,000 to $80,000. So for the inputs into a single family house in the last 2 years have gone up 36%. And you see similar cost increases for multifamily construction. And that includes not only lumber, but that includes all of the things that go into a house, whether drywall, electrical fixtures, plumbing, appliances, all of that has gone up largely because of demand increase, but also supply chain disruptions.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, looking at the high cost of housing, a lot of factors leading to the cost of houses going up, also rent going up. You can join in with your questions, maybe your own personal experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Kurt, we've got this a large generation of millennials. It's a time in their lives when historically, they'd be expected to want to buy a house. What is the reality facing them right now?
Well, as we like to say, it's almost a perfect storm for millennials. So the peak millennial, which is the largest generation in American history, is about 30 or 31 years old today. So that's peak home buying years. So if you look at what happened to the median price of a home for purchase during the pandemic, in a lot of Wisconsin counties, that went up 50 to 75,000 in the pandemic. So that means that the entry level price, that bottom rung of the housing ladder, is increasingly out of reach for millennials. Second, because of student loan debt that a lot of millennials have, a dollar in student loan debt is a dollar that you cannot put to mortgage debt because of changes to mortgage underwriting rules after the Great Recession in 2008. The third component is as your rents keep going up and your costs keep going up, it's harder and harder to save for that down payment. So in some ways, it's a triple whammy, and it means that millennials might be persistently shut out of the housing market because even if they can find something to buy in this tight supply market, they're outcompeted by borrowers who can pay all cash or who will waive inspection contingency. And then the fourth factor, as you heard in the news report today, interest rates are going up. The Federal Reserve just today raised their target interest rate 50 basis points or half a percentage point. And what we will expect is that mortgage rates, which have already climbed a lot in the last 2 months, that mortgage interest rates will go up again in the coming days and weeks.
Can you talk a little about the renter market? You mentioned rents going up. What is driving that?
So like a lot of factors, it's a combination of too much demand and too little supply. So rents in most Wisconsin counties have gone up 10 to even 15 or 20% in the last 2 years. A couple of things are driving that. Number one, a lot of people who would otherwise own a home have been shut out of the ownership market, and so they are staying in the rental market or entering the rental market. That provides competition. The second factor is that the cost of building new rental housing has also gone up about 30 or 35%. So we like to say that the closest substitute for new housing is existing housing, or the closest substitute for existing housing is new housing. So in both the single family and the rental side, when the cost to build new stuff goes way up, then the price of the existing stuff also goes up just because they're substitutes for each other in the market. So a combination of not building enough housing and increased demand and then increased cost of new stuff means that rents have gone up 10 or 15%. And we'll also point out that for most renters, even though their income has gone up during the pandemic, the rent has gone up more, which means on net, you're further behind.
We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about the housing crisis in Wisconsin, housing costs going up, rent costs too, and what it might take to make housing in the state more affordable. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you struggled to try to buy a home with the big price increases during the pandemic? Success or no? Does buying a home feel completely off the table for you? If you rent, what are you seeing? Are you able to live anywhere near where you work? If you work in housing construction or in rentals, what are you seeing out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, look at some possible solutions coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a lack of affordable housing in Wisconsin, how that can impact everyone, especially the large group of millennials who are at the typical home buying age. Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We want to hear your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experience as a renter, a homeowner, somebody trying to buy or sell a home right now, or if you're in building, are you able to get the supplies you need at a reasonable price? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We heard from Bella in southeastern Wisconsin, Kurt, who wondered in part, why aren't politicians doing something to tackle this problem?
Well, that's a great question. I think the reason you don't see a lot of legislative initiatives is it's difficult, it's complicated, and it's expensive. But largely, I think it's because it's been a slow-burning crisis that's been building over the last decade. And if truth be told, you know, the majority of Americans, the majority of Wisconsinites, live in homes that they already own. And for those of us who already live in owned homes, it's actually not a crisis, is it? Because we see that our values are going up. Now, of course, we can't realize that gain until we sell. And if you sell, you have to move somewhere else that's also more expensive. But I think that's the main reason, is that it's a slow-burning crisis. It's not an immediate kind of crisis that drives people to do something. But I would always point out to economic development officials, legislators, that if you don't take any action, then you're going to continue to see these trends continue. And we can just project out where that goes. And if house prices keep going up, and home ownership for low and moderate income households, for first-time home buyers, for young people continues to go down, we're just going to continue to have this challenge in the state.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hi.
Hi. Yeah, they should have never did away with the first-time homeowners buyers program that HUD had out that helped me get a house and several people I know.
And Tim, could I ask, how long ago were you able to use that program to get your first house?
Yeah, it was about 5 years ago now.
Tim, thanks for the call. I'm not familiar with it, the first-time homeowner program, excuse me, Kurt, via Housing and Urban Development.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually a large number of first-time homebuyer programs, which can include down payment assistance programs. I know that our state housing agency, WEDA, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, has a number of resources and programs available for first-time homebuyers. I think he may be referring to after 2008, there was a short-lived first-time homebuyer tax credit at the federal level, which really did help a lot of people to be able to buy that first home. And so I think we should definitely encourage our legislators at the state and federal level to think about what are the various financial incentives that help younger people to buy that first home, whether it's a reduced cost on the mortgage, whether it's down payment assistance programs, whether it's perhaps tax-advantaged savings programs so that people can save for down payment. I think, as Tim pointed out, a lot of people, including in my generation, were able to get help through these various first-time home buyer programs. And a lot of those have just become not as well-funded. And of course, you know, for many first-time home buyers, saving for that down payment is one of the hardest tasks. And they are sitting there and seeing that as house prices keep going up, the dollars they have to save for a down payment are also going up. So anything we can do, whether it's student loan relief or matching programs with employers or even tax-advantaged savings accounts to help people save for that down payment will help us to create purchase-ready homeowners.
Thanks for that call, Tim, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Kurt Paulson, professor of urban planning at UW-Madison, looking at the high cost of housing in Wisconsin, renting and buying. You can join in still with your story at 800-642-1234 or your possible solutions. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Kurt, is part of the story the kind of housing, the size of houses, the number of bedrooms, the units available to people?
Yes. So one of the things we know is that the fastest growing household type is one and two person households. As we have fewer children and as we age, we have households that no longer meet that kind of, 1950s sitcom nuclear family that needs a three or four bedroom house. So one of the things we have to think about doing is providing more flexibility to builders to build smaller condo units or townhouse units, or even what are sometimes called accessory dwelling units or granny flats, ways that people can live in smaller housing units rather than the traditional kind of suburban large-scale home on a large-scale lot. Unfortunately, I think a lot of our communities, because in their zoning ordinances and in what they want that larger home on the larger lot. But the truth is that's just not the majority of households that we see demanding housing today. So any flexibility you can have at a local level to let builders build smaller, more flexible housing types will really help us address this backlog of housing needs.
Let's go back to our callers now. Justin is with us in Madison. Justin, hello.
Yeah, I had a question about how you believe Airbnb and VRBO rentals play a role in the cost of housing.
Justin, thanks for that call. Kurt, I've heard concerns in some communities very popular with tourists in particular where, housing that people could live in is instead is being bought and rented out via those services Justin mentioned.
Right. And I've heard this to be much more of a concern in those really expensive coastal metros like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and New York. And I can imagine it would be a concern in Madison or Green Bay or Milwaukee. But the truth is, I don't think in these housing markets, you're seeing a whole lot of demand for Airbnb. But one of the solutions is either to regulate what homeowners can do with their homes, or it's also to just allow more houses to be built in areas where there's a lot of demand for this type of housing. So I guess that's kind of a Weasley answer. I don't know whether it's really a problem in Wisconsin, but I know it's a big concern on the coast.
Justin, thanks for the call. Sonia joins us now in Rice Lake. Sonia, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Sonia?
So my partner and I just bought a house in Rice Lake, Wisconsin, which is about 45 minutes north of Eau Claire. The big problem that we were having was trying to buy a house with a down payment and being priced out basically by people who would bring in all cash offers.
Wow. You were able, yep. You were successful eventually though, Sonia.
Yeah. It took a little finagling and finding a house that no one wanted, but we got one.
Well, I'm glad you've got a house and I hope you want it, Sonia. Thanks for sharing that. Sonia, not alone in that, Kurt.
No, absolutely. We hear this story all the time. And what it really means is if you are one of these first-time home buyers, and maybe you're using one of the government programs that helps first-time home buyers, whether that is FHA, or if you have a Veterans Administration loan or a USDA loan in rural areas like Barron County, where Sonia is, those require an inspection of the property. And many buyers, when they think that there's multiple offers, they're going to choose the offer that is all cash, doesn't have a finance contingency or an inspection contingency. So as Sonia pointed out, most of our first-time home buyers, our younger families, are getting outbid. And a lot of them don't want to or cannot pay $30,000 or $50,000 over asking price, because especially now with mortgage rates going up, they're kind of stretching even to buy that entry-level house price point. So again, the market is really out of whack right now. It's going to start cooling down a little bit because of the interest rate increases. But that's further bad news for people who want to buy homes because their dollar doesn't stretch as far as it used to.
Sonia, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Tom?
Are you there?
Yep, go for it.
Okay. I am a landlord. I have a lot of single-family, two-family duplexes. We just had a place for rent on Facebook, and typically 98 out of 100 people that call or email us, I should say, have bad credit, police calls where they're at, evictions, no income, poor landlord references. And even though there's a lot of people that can't find housing, I think the reason that they can't find housing is because they have a poor track record.
Tom, thanks for the call. We don't have too much time left, but Kurt, if you are, I guess landlords might think of them as marginal renters, somebody who doesn't have a great credit history and other things Tom listed, that's got to be even more difficult to find housing.
Right, and it's a double-edged sword because you can understand why landlords might be hesitant to rent to someone with that credit, but also when rental markets are really tight, landlords get really choosy. And so folks who have maybe a ding on their credit history or an eviction, they make it makes it really hard to find housing. And that's where largely our housing service agencies, our nonprofits, can really work with clients and help them to present a good application to provide wraparound or supportive services as needed. But I'll be honest, you hear stories on both sides and it's pretty rough out there. If you can't find a decent place to live, you still have to find some place to live. And oftentimes, people who are the most marginalized or vulnerable end up in really kind of precarious housing situations, as Tom was talking about.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Kurt, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me again.
That's Kurt Paulson with UW-Madison's Department of Urban Planning, looking at an affordability crisis in Wisconsin's housing market. Coming up, what could a post-Roe v. Wade America look like in light of the leaked Supreme Court draft decision indicating it's willing to overturn constitutional protections for abortion? I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.